Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The momentum of history has two sides, such as being propelled to greater achievements as a result of the past, or its downside, history as a coffin, and each passing moment or incident, another nail hammering it shut. February has been honored as Black History Month since the USA's bicentennial year of 1976, which is more urgently relevant in this new millennium as a result of the ugly racism that covers the USA like a choking, blinding smog that discolors nearly everything. I start today's program with a tribute to Abraham Lincoln's birthday this month, which I do every year to honor a request by a friend, Rick Vranya, who died a few years ago. He was a cartographer for the city of Warrenton, and his mind was a map of the universe. Ironically, on the same date as Lincoln's birthday, 16 years earlier, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed by Congress on February 12, 1793, which required all states, including those that prohibited slavery, to forcibly return all escaped slaves to their slave owners. So now I read again my annual, The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln. And as mentioned earlier, I wrote it, so I'm responsible for it. And a quote by Hope Tucker, "The United States is guilty of original sin, and that sin is slavery." And Martin Luther King Jr., "There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges." Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States, will be 214 years old this coming Sunday. He was born on a Sunday, February 12, 1809, the same day as Charles Darwin, and was murdered on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, at the age of 56. He was shot in the back of the head while attending a stage play by an embittered actor who thought his bullet would reverse the loss of a civil war just ended. For most of the world, Lincoln is the symbol of the United States. For Americans, his worn, gaunt, and terribly sad face is our conscience. He is revered as almost a saintly human being, and with Karl Marx, is probably the other most significant political figure of the 19th century, and certainly the most compelling in American history. Lincoln grew to power from poverty and obscurity. He was raised on the frontier and taught himself law. He is probably the nation's most successful politician. Just prior to his election as president, he was hardly known outside Illinois. At his inauguration in 1861, he was the most reviled man in the country, yet immediately after his death, he was regarded the most beloved. He almost single-handedly held the sundered Union to its successful and awesomely bloody purpose of defeating the secession of the Confederacy. More than almost any man of his era, he grew to understand the importance of the unity of the United States. Without unity, the nation would be the victim of other rapacious powers that wish to obliterate the fledgling split democracy and expropriate its vast spaces and incredibly rich resources. He passionately believed the doctrine of political freedom would disappear from the world if the United States dissolved. Ironically, his election as president severed the nation. And just as ironically, the division of the nation centered on the question of political and individual freedom of black slaves. Although Lincoln believed that the abolition of slavery was an historical inevitability and the intent of the majority of the framers of the American Constitution, his dramatic act of emancipation halfway through the Civil War, more than any other act, made him one of the most memorable and important figures in history. Lincoln had very little personal acquaintance with slavery, although he had witnessed it on the river landings of Missouri and southern Illinois, and in particular during his single term in Congress in Washington, D.C., which at that time, in the 1840s, was a major warehouse for the slave trade, by then illegal, but not slavery itself. He thought slavery violated the doctrine of equal rights, but he never quite abandoned the idea of white superiority. For most of his struggle against slavery, he did not believe that whites and blacks could coexist without economic dislocation and violence, and preferred establishing colonies of former slaves in South or Central America in much the manner as Liberia in Africa. He was opposed to immediate emancipation and initially believed that slavery could be slowly and patiently eradicated without disunion. He thought a policy of containment by free states would eventually strangle slavery. The secession of the Confederacy altered his hopes. Though he still believed emancipation would lead to catastrophe and initially resisted radical abolitionists, he needed a strong, clear, driving force to continue support for the war against the southern states to justify the intensifying bloodiness and appalling Union losses. He also wanted to instill terror in the South, which had always been haunted by the specter of a massive slave uprising. Yet he wished no revenge upon the South, unlike many northern politicians and abolitionists, and his original plans for Reconstruction following the war gave no political power to the freed slaves in the defeated Confederacy, nor were they to be allowed to vote. Although he became convinced that blacks and whites would have to remain together because separatism was infeasible, he continued to believe the status quo had to change gradually if change was to be successful. It was his feeling several generations would have to pass before blacks were capable and educated enough to assume political power. Their chances for economic freedom were nil, and it is probable he was also aware that sudden enfranchisement of power and wealth would result in a brutal backlash against blacks in both North and South. Lincoln might not have been able to prevent the opportunistic revenge upon the South, but his death ensured it. Its result was a counter-revenge, not upon the white carpetbaggers who infested the South after the Civil War, but upon freed slaves who were terrorized and murdered. White supremacy groups grew up on the fringes of Southern anger. The most dominant and ruthless, the Night Riders of the Ku Klux Klan. Lynchings of blacks were commonplace following the Civil War and lasted until the seventh decade of the 20th century. After nearly a century and a half after emancipation, the United States finally elected a black president. Yet, more than two decades into the 21st century, the overwhelming majority of American blacks are still without position or power. And although the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s dramatized and somewhat improved black prospects, the pervasive racism that continues to saturate American society strips away the few advances that have been achieved. American history is taught from primarily a white perspective, which is only a portion of our history, and without integrating it with black American history, it is irrelevant, and worse, it is a lie that perpetuates the racism that underlies and embitters our truly pluralistic history. African blacks and European whites were parallel colonizers of the Western Hemisphere, and together they built the civilization that currently exists in North and South America. The primary difference is that black immigration was a forced migration. Millions of blacks were brought in chains from Africa as slaves for four centuries. Slavery evolved as the result of the need for an abundant and relatively cheap supply of labor in the colonized Americas, and the traffic in slaves was itself probably the most profitable international trade in history. Entire industries were built on the commerce of human slaves, and as cruel as it was, which induced an opaqueness to the torment inflicted by the trade, the extent and profitability of slavery built cities and helped raise the capital that started the Industrial Revolution in England. Much of Africa was emptied to provide slaves for the European colonies in the Americas, and most of Africa was colonized by European nations. Africans who were not sent across the oceans as slaves were enslaved at home. No one will ever know precisely how many millions of blacks were killed in their villages in four centuries of slave raids, but it is estimated that about one-third of those captured died en route to the coasts or while imprisoned awaiting embarkation, and another third aboard ships in which they were chained and stacked like cords of wood in overcrowded, filthy holds, and during the seasoning process of slavery, worked to death in stifling climates, beaten and murdered if they were slow to obey or attempted to escape. When the slave trade was finally declared illegal at the end of the 18th century, its illicitness made it even more profitable in much the manner as the current international drug trade, and as with illegal drugs, when capture is imminent, uncounted thousands of black men, women, and children were thrown overboard to drown in the ocean, chained together, whenever a naval patrol caught up with a slave ship. The trade was also profitable because it was easier to work a slave to death and buy a new one than it was to breed and feed newer generations, although that, of course, was also done. Slavery in the Americas took two separate directions. In the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in South and Central America, slavery continued the long tradition of Mediterranean slavery, practiced most famously in classical times. Roman slaves were granted not only freedom, but much prized Roman citizenship, and it was incorporated in the Iberian Catholic religious doctrine, which claimed that although slaves were of the lowest social order, both masters and slaves possessed souls that were regarded as equals by God. The tendency, therefore, was that slaves were human beings with some rights and some legal means by which they might achieve freedom. The legal structures of the North American colonies and the British West Indies, and later the United States, did not recognize slaves as human beings entitled to human rights. The ancient and medieval experiences with slavery had been forgotten, and Northern Europe did not have a comparable tradition with the Iberian nations. There was no slave law and no concern for blacks in their religious doctrines. More problematic for the future was a tendency of Northern Europeans and Americans to identify blacks with slavery. The mere fact of being black was presumptive of slave status. Slavery was considered perpetual, and chances of working toward freedom were few. To be black was to be a slave, without rights to marriage, children, whose value was only as prospective slaves, property, or the product of their work. Yet, despite the differences of the slave system of South and North America, they were only differences of degree. Wherever there was slavery, there was a slave society, not merely for blacks, but for whites also. blacks and whites were bound together in cruel and bitter antagonism, but also in a complex relationship that could not express itself without reference to each other. It was a class relationship that became ever more defined as a racial one. North American Southern society in particular was enclosed and closed off by its slave system. Southern slave society grew from the same historical conditions that produced the world's other slave regimes. The rise of the world market and the need for cheap labor encouraged slavery, and only the advent of mechanical technology and industrialism rendered it inefficient and ultimately incapable of competing in the very market that created it. The South was haunted by its guilt and fear of slavery. Enslaving blacks was justified through claims that it was God's intent, that whites were superior to blacks, that slavery civilized blacks and elevated them above their former status as jungle savages, and that, in essence, whites were carrying out God's law by making slaves and Christians out of pagan blacks. In reality, Southern plantations were battlefields where slaves fought masters for physical and psychological survival. And although they were unlettered, outnumbered, and unarmed, black slaves struggled in as many ways as they could to preserve their humanity against virtually inhuman odds. Southern whites bitterly resisted acknowledging the humanity of their black slaves, which was contradictory of their claim of God's edict to Christianize them. Underlying their pious justifications was a terror of the system they had fabricated. The culture of the antebellum South was continually in dread of slave insurrection, and any outbreak was savagely suppressed. In a sense, a reason for perpetuating slavery was the fear of reprisal once it was abolished. Most Northern whites also considered themselves superior to blacks, and the desire to abolish slavery had more to do with this interference with paid labor than with human rights. Even a majority of the Northern abolitionists who risked imprisonment and their lives, providing underground systems of escape for runaway slaves, felt, as Abraham Lincoln, that blacks should dwell apart from whites. Yet, ultimately, however intense the economic dialectics regarding slavery, and perhaps because the climate of industrialism allowed it, the most important reason for the abolition of slavery was the moral one. The idea of the inherent value of a human being outlasted slavery and was the chief source of its undoing. There were many reasons for the division of the young nation, South from North, but at its core was the inhumanity of slavery. Frank Tannenbaum, in his book, Slave and Citizen, wrote that inherent in the history of slavery was an important contribution to the theory of social change. Wherever the law accepted the doctrine of the moral personality, quote unquote, of the slave, and made possible the gradual achievement of freedom implicit in such a doctrine, the slave system was abolished peacefully. Where the slave was denied recognition as a moral person and was therefore incapable of freedom, the abolition of slavery was accomplished by violence and revolution. Americans cannot separate our history from the long centuries of slavery. Without black slaves from Africa, much of the Western Hemisphere would not have been converted into an enclave of European civilization. The fight for independence that characterized the American Revolution did not include liberty for slaves, and the oversight caused the Civil War 80 years afterward. Emancipation only brought a semblance of physical relief from slavery, and its underlying racism has definitely not been eradicated 2 centuries later. If the class system of slavery is defined by color, then a post-slavery society becomes a form of apartheid, which has been the result of the United States since the Civil War, and which was starkly dramatized in the violence unleashed against the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. At the third millennium of our era, the U.S. remains a divided nation. And as Lincoln famously said, though he was not the first to say it, a house divided will not long stand. Blacks as well as whites wish for mutual separation, but there is really no other place to go. Just as whites are no longer Europeans, American blacks are not Africans anymore. For better or worse, blacks and whites are hybrid Americans. Slaves or free, the arduous, tragic, and unequal role of black Americans in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Just as the word history seems to imply only male endeavor, his story, so does it also imply Western European white dominance and supremacy over world affairs. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, especially in the last generation and more, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of the 18th century enlightenment that gave birth to the United States than any other. This struggle is a continuation of what Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, the Adamses et al. Started and unfortunately denied people of color, who were regarded as property rather than persons born equal and certainly not born free. Lincoln's executive order of emancipation went into effect January 1, 1863. Though it abolished slavery in the Confederate states, but not those under Union control, its legality was doubtful according to U.S. civil law. To remedy any deficiencies in the proclamation in regard to its legal standing, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was introduced in Congress in 1864 and was ratified in 1865, the year the Civil War ended. It abolished slavery or involuntary servitude in the United States or anywhere under U.S. jurisdiction. The Emancipation Proclamation, although it raised the conflict for union to an issue of international moral principle, had little initial practical impact because Lincoln at the time had no authority in the Confederacy. Lincoln had proposed the proclamation the previous summer. Secretary of State William Seward suggested he wait to announce it until after a significant Union battlefield victory, so that European governments would not misinterpret it as a final shriek in our retreat, quote unquote. Lincoln had said at the start of the Civil War, "If I could preserve the Union by freeing all the slaves everywhere, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do so. If I could preserve the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I would do so." His critics and some supporters thought the proclamation was a cynical act by a weak, vacillating president. Yet by conceding to free the few, he struck to the heart of the conflict and never afterward wavered from his promise. He got his victory at Sharpsburg, Maryland on September 16, 1862, near a little creek and a church named after it that forever gave the battle its name, Antietam. The Union Army routed a Confederate invasion of the North. It was the single bloodiest day of the Civil War, at least 15,000 dead on both sides and another 20,000 wounded or missing. Union losses alone were twice as many as those on the Normandy D-Day landings 82 years later in World War II. 5 days after Antietam, Lincoln issued his proclamation. On the first day of January 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall then be thenceforth and forever free. If my name ever goes into history, Lincoln said, it was for this act. It took a century and a Southern president, a member of the party of traitors, quote unquote, formerly Southern Democrats, to take the next step of what emancipation began. Lyndon Johnson successfully pushed through Congress the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act of 1965. He said, 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived. They came in darkness and in chains. The story of our nation and of the American Negro are like two rivers that flow through the centuries along divided channels. When the Liberty Bell rang out in Philadelphia, it did not toll for the Negro. When Andrew Jackson threw open the doors of democracy, they did not open for the Negro. It was only at Appomattox a century ago that an American victory was also a Negro victory, and the two rivers, one shining with promise, the other dark-stained with oppression, began to move toward one another. And that was Lyndon Johnson. But rivers of blood coursed between them. That same year of 1965, the Watts riot in Los Angeles erupted, and 27 years later, in the spring of 1992, the worst domestic riot in U.S. history occurred in the same place because white police who savagely beat a black man senseless were acquitted by an all-white jury. With few exceptions, American blacks are contained and isolated in urban ghettos in much the manner Nazis forced Jews into European ghettos. They are denied adequate education, employment, housing, or health care. In at least one disgraceful instance, water fit to drink. They are forced to subsist on doles, stingily appropriated, which are exploited as examples for abolishing welfare. Black rage against the injustices inflicted upon them is forced inward against themselves. The barely constrained contempt whites hold for blacks is probably equally felt toward whites by blacks who are victims of the antipathy. But outnumbered 10-1, without the tremendous legal strength and firepower of the whites, they are generally unable to strike back without horrendous consequences. White-dominated police forces act in black communities as if they were foreign occupying armies. Most of the time, as Thomas Jefferson noted in the Declaration of Independence, people patiently endure the iron heel, but an excessive act, such as the acquittal of the policeman who assaulted Rodney King in 1992, or the more recent police murders of unarmed black men and women, can be the final ignominy that erupts thermonuclear reaction, which can be terrible to witness or be a part of. In both the Watts and 1992 race riots in Los Angeles, crowds rampaged the first couple of days and nights, randomly burning and looting. Police and National Guard responded with heavy firepower. Firemen were attacked and forced to avoid fires because of the violence and incapacity to respond to so many. Entire city blocks were on fire in Watts in 1965 and Greater Central LA in 1992. And similarly, non-black owned or operated liquor stores, markets, and other businesses in the black community torched and looted. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is this program's engineer. The first newspaper on the Pacific Coast, the Oregon Spectator, began publishing on February 5, 1846. And Oregonians might not remember that February 14th honors the martyrdom of St. Valentine by pagan Romans in 270 AD, but they certainly will celebrate Oregon's 164th Statehood Day on that same date in memory of his pioneer history. The great American Western artist, Charles Marion Russell, who had long been a cowboy, a trapper, and also lived for a time with a native tribe, was once asked to address a meeting of Montana boosters shortly before his death in 1926. He was introduced as a pioneer, which made him mad. He said, "In my book, a pioneer is a man who comes to a virgin country, traps off all the fur, kills off all the wild meat, cuts down all the trees, grazes off all the grass, plows the roots up, and strings 10 millions of miles of barbed wire over the dust. A pioneer destroys things and calls it civilization. I wish to God that this country was just like it was when I first saw it, and that none of you folks were here at all." Several of Charles Russell's great paintings were of Lewis and Clark among the Indians on their trek to the Oregon country and on the lower Columbia River, painted nearly a century later. Happy Oregon's Day, this February 14th.